You are listening to Sparking Wholeness with Erin Carey, where we talk about all things related to nutrition for mind, body, and soul. Are you ready? Let's do this. Hey, everybody, it's Erin Carey. Welcome back to Sparking Wholeness. Today, I'm sitting down with Chris Legg. He is a licensed professional counselor, married since 1993, owner and lead therapist for Aletheia Family Counseling, and also he is the lead pastor at South Spring Baptist Church, 25 years experience in marriage and family counseling, frequent speaker. He is passionate about teaching people the truth, how to live in freedom, and build their identity in Christ. And today, we are talking about his book that is called On Sex and Marriage, which is always such an important topic to discuss. So welcome, Chris, to the show.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad that you're here. This is going to be fun because I do get a lot of requests for marriage episodes. And honestly, I've done a few marriage episodes with other experts, but then some have just been done me and my husband because that's sure. Relatable, right? But I've been reading your book and you have so much interesting wisdom in there, not just like from the counseling perspective, but also from a biblical perspective, from a theological perspective. There's a lot to break down. So tell me a little bit, getting started, what brought you to write the book? Oh, and I need to tell listeners that you co-wrote it with your son, which is totally wild to me. I have an adult child, and yes. And that's a whole different stage. But yeah, yes. I'd love to hear about what brought you to write.
So that was writing the book with Mark. I'll just comment on that. So yeah. What was wild was when we started writing the book, Mark was not even engaged. He had never had sex and was not married. And he's like, "Here I am, helping write a book on sex and marriage." But so what it turned into, Erin, was me paying my son, because I had tried several other co-writers and co-authors and even ghostwriters to try to figure out, because I do okay writing in like article length, that kind of stuff. I do okay. But beyond that, if I break up the writing, my tone gets lost. And when I come back, I'm like a different person. So it's very bohemian to try to read what I write. And so my son, though, his analytical mind can take my ideas, and other people, no one got me. And so he was the first author, writer who got me, obviously raised by me, but he got me in the way I thought. And then he could take my thoughts and make them cohesive and even coherent and create a formula that what we would do is we had the same document online, and we would just take turns editing it until we found both of our voices kind of together.
Yeah.
We're doing that for another book now, Identity and Intimacy. Hopefully we'll be out at some point. But it was a fascinating. So I got to pay my son to spend an hour with me once a week for him to learn everything I believe about sex and marriage. During that year, he got engaged and married. It was like, if the book had never happened, me getting an hour a week with him to talk about sex and marriage was worth every penny of that time together. So it's great. It was a gift.
That's really
and
cool.
You said he helped you write some stuff.
Yes. We've crossed paths with Denison Forum. So I think that's all so fun and connected. And he's awesome. And so I think what I find fascinating about your book, and I'd love to kind of touch on that a little bit, just the structure of it and how and what your desire was in writing it, because yeah, sure, we have lots of sex and marriage books out there, but I do think that you take a unique approach where it is the practical counselor type of approach. It's also the pastoral type of approach, which are very different. If people don't understand, they are very different or can be. You're blending them. And then there's just the whole biblical, it's all intertwined. So what was your thought with that?
Just honestly, part of why it's so long, Erin, it's kind of a bummer. Marriage books really should probably be about half the length that ours is. But the problem is, we thought about doing two books, the book on marriage and the book on sex, but then we were afraid no one would ever read the book on marriage. They would jump straight to the book on sex.
Totally. Yeah.
To understand how sex is supposed to be lived out in marriage, you have to understand what marriage is. And so that's why you have this integrated concept. And all truth is God's truth, whether it's come through empirical evidence or through biblical revelation. And so integrating the truth, and so often, sadly, pastors in the past have bought into this transactional version of marriage.
Absolutely.
And you understand how they got there. They just don't know not to. And sometimes counselors have as well this sociological caveman, cavewoman trap. He wants sex, she wants protection. Well, they can make a kind of a mini contract and then trade commodities. And that's what the world believes marriage is. But it was wild to me to look back on all these Christian marriage books that, whether they mean to or not, essentially unpack this transactional, very unhealthy, detrimental version of marriage that's crippling for both people. Sometimes men don't realize how crippling it is. Women do realize how crippling it is, that transactional marriage model. And all you got to do is go on Amazon and read the reviews of a lot of those marriage books from that era. And for everyone that's saying, like, this really helped my marriage, there's another one that's saying, this ended my marriage. And that you don't want your book to do both of those things, for
So
sure.
true.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a tricky, I mean, just even writing a marriage book through the lens of biblical truth is tricky enough, but then you have societal idea of what marriage is and Christian societal idea of what marriage is, which doesn't always line up with the scripture. So even just starting out, so let's just start with the foundation of marriage and why a healthy marriage matters for whole person well-being and for whole person health.
That's great. So when we were doing some research, I was seeing early on in my marriage counseling work, couples coming in devastated by these different aspects, including their sex life very often, which is clearly not what was intended by God. And so they come in and they're off base, and they would read, often they would read a marriage book, sometimes Christian, sometimes not Christian. And I remember distinctly hearing a woman coming in and saying, after reading one of the most, maybe the best selling to this day, Christian marriage book, and she came in and said, so in other words, my husband just wants a prostitute who cleans his house. And
Yep, that's
I
what
was like,
they say.
wow. I mean, they really, and I thought back and I was like, that kind of does say that, doesn't it? But then what I thought was, but then why don't men have prostitutes who clean their house? If that's what we wanted, that's what we would have. So that's obviously not what we want. A book that says that must be off base. And it wasn't really until the Feldens started doing actual research before they published Christian marriage books. I know that's a novel concept, actual research, and discovered that none of this, all of these narratives about men's relationship to sex and women's were just wrong. And they were not biblical, but they also were just unsound. So in the book, I unpack, like, Esther's relationship to Xerxes, how that was, should have been this abusive, and may have been an abusive, domineering, essentially sex trafficking story, and yet still somehow Xerxes is fascinated by a woman choosing him. Well, that's the worst condition, and there's something there. What about when it's not that condition? What's going on? And so that made me go back honestly, to the drawing board and try to figure out, what is marriage? What actually is it? What did God reveal about it? It's not two cave people. It was two humans that God designed and created. And that's one of my favorite chapters in the book. Mark really had a huge impact on, was the telling. He wanted to write the explanation of marriage backwards, as though I was trying to solve a problem and invent something where people actually got the most fulfilling and most valuable version of life in the most fulfilling and most valuable way, which means freely as a gift. And he wrote, and we wrote it, and as we wrote it, getting to the realization, this may have been the thought process that God went through to in order to create, research, and design marriage. And we know there's extensive evidence, and I know you know this, that satisfying marriages, every research article that's done on this, satisfying marriages boost physical health, they boost longevity, they boost all those different things. And married people have longer life expectancies, especially men. Married mothers have lower rates of depression than single or even cohabitating mothers. Research has linked all these things. I was reading through some of, like, I've got a list here. Disorders of mood, anxiety, substance abuse, personality disorders. High quality marriages appear to buffer people against psychological stress. That's which means, and by the way, the opposite is true. Unhealthy marriages magnify those distresses and magnify those health issues. And you'll appreciate, I actually found a study. This was money to me. 2021, I hadn't seen it before now, is that they actually evaluated joint health behaviors, meaning, okay, so maybe the reason healthy marriages tend to be healthier people is just because they do make healthy choices together. They eat better together, they exercise better together, or they sleep better together, right? This study showed that happily married couples who have the health benefits of being happily married, there was only an inconsistent, to quote them, slight and inconsistent correlation to the joint health behaviors. In other words, happy marriages create health benefits that aren't just based on healthy habits that people have. Isn't
Yeah.
that wild? So even people who have unhealthy habits together are still healthier than people who are unhappily married. And so I was like, that's powerful stuff.
That's fun. I mean, it reminds me of my quote. I always say a body in stress won't digest. It's like no matter what you eat, if you're stressed out eating it, it's going to slow down digestion, right? So same thing with marriage. I mean, you can both be, working out together and eating well, but if you're miserable and you're not working on your marriage, then how is that going to impact your health? That's really interesting to
And
me.
apparently it's a big causation. At least that's what the article is about. And I can send you the links to these,
I'd
but
love to see that. Yeah,
and
that's
I'll
fun.
bet Aaron, you and your husband have done when you're doing marriage conversations and marriage counseling. Now, I know there are a lot of reasons that people have chronic illness diagnoses, but it is wild how often people who are in abusive and unhealthy marriages also just happen to, of sometime during their marriage, developed a chronic illness diagnosis. And I don't think that's accidental. I'm in a happy marriage. I'm in a really good marriage, but man, when things are stressed between me and my wife, I am stressed. Everything else seems insignificant. And so the thought of being in a marriage that is constantly stressful, abusive, and unhealthy, you can imagine. I got to quote these to you as well. One more. And that was the Gottmans, who, of course, kind of the secular marriage gurus, at least. An unhappy marriage, according to their research, can increase the chance of illness by 35%.
Yeah, that's crazy, but I
That's,
believe it.
I do too. I
Yeah.
totally believe it. And so
Yeah.
what we wanted to do in this book, and that's why the subtitle is about finding, restoring for marriages that have lost this, and most of us have been married longer than 6 years or so, have now gotten on different pages about what marriage is meant to be and what sexual satisfaction is meant to be and what sex means. And so that's kind of broken, and now you've got this, he doesn't understand her issue with sexuality. And she feels like she has to spend this energy. Like if she doesn't engage sexually, she's going to pay this emotional price. And there's an unhealthy dynamic that's created. And how do you disentangle that? And it can take months or years of intentionally disentangling it, but it's so worthwhile when you do. And it never is perfect. You'll love the Feldon's new sex book, which I highly recommend as well. They discovered that only 10% of couples have similar sexual thresholds. That,
Interesting.
in other
Yeah,
words,
makes sense.
90% don't. 70% of the time, let's see, it's 70% of the time, men desire sexual interaction more often than the woman. And in 20% of the case, the woman desires it more often than the man. Only in 10% of the case are the thresholds similar enough that they don't notice that someone has to spend energy to sacrifice a little bit. And or both of them don't have to, which is actually the way that I think God actually created marriage. But
That's
that's
interesting. Do you think that's where most of the, I mean, especially in your experience as a counselor, like, is that where most of the sex conflict comes from? One person has more of a drive than the other, and then they're, is that where it comes from, or what else?
that's often what triggers it. But the that's not what causes it, but that's often when they spot it. And so the theory that I have and that we espouse in the book is that typically women don't integrate sexuality into their identity at an intuitive level. And men do. And so when a woman is pursuing a man sexually, his intuition is she's pursuing me. And when she rejects sex with me, she's rejecting me. Most often, when women, if a man pursues a woman sexually, her intuition is to think he's pursuing sex. And so what that means is because she divides them out, her identity from her sexuality. In fact, most people of your sex, you've carried around your own sexuality sometimes like a stake that draws dogs. It's like, is this guy interested in me or is he just interested in sex? And the world, and even sadly, the church has often taught you to think that way. Whereas most men can't we can't think that way if we try. Like a big part of my training is teaching men to think that way so they can understand how their wife thinks. So the one of the first early on, another one of the early on moments that got me to this was having a woman say in counseling, "I wish my husband would touch me more non-sexually." And as a man, I had no intuition for what she was talking about. I had to be like, okay, so I had to ask, okay, I mean, I didn't let it show, but I'm like, okay, unpack that for me, which meant I have no idea what you're describing here. And of course, it didn't take me long to realize she meant the parts of her body covered by her underwear. But men don't typically divide out touch that way. We don't think in those terms of like, this is a sex, this is my sexual partner, so I touch them as sexually as the situation allows, or calls for. Not, I don't arbitrarily decide like I could touch her this much, but I'm not going to because somehow there's an arbitrary meaning in that that I don't understand. And so learning to see it through her lens and her learning to see it through his lens is a big part of what this book is about. But you have to understand that marriage is about learning to engage with the other person's thresholds in order to do that. So yes, frequency is a piece of the pie, and when they notice it, because usually that means she has to spend psychological energy to engage sexually, and he doesn't because it's part of his identity. And there's things that you have to spend energy on, or that your husband has to spend energy on for each other. If one of you is an introvert or an extrovert or a spender or a saver, or pick anything that's a threshold is different, a risk taker or a non-risk taker. And so, you know, if and by the way, that's how thresholds work. And this people don't understand this is, so if my wife, if she starts feeling anxiety if dishes are in the sink longer than 24 hours. So let's say that that's she starts getting stressed if she sees dirty dishes in the sink longer than 24 hours. And then let's say I'm a guy who gets stressed if dishes are in the sink longer than 8 hours. Okay. So if they're in there longer than 8 hours, I start getting stressed. Then we get married. Now, how often is my wife going to feel stress about the dishes? Never again, because I'm never going to let it go 24 hours. And so that my threshold becomes the limiting factor for that. Now, where it's a problem is if I get my feelings hurt that she doesn't feel what I feel. So my threshold is I learn to go, it's been 12 hours. She doesn't even notice it yet because that's not hit her threshold. Or if I get nervous if the kids are 5 feet from the road and she gets nervous if they're 25 feet from the road, well, I'm never going to feel nervous again because she's never going to let them get 5 feet from a road. And so I have to learn to go, okay, they're 15 feet from a road. She's probably really nervous out of love. I probably ought to move the kids even though I don't feel it.
That's interesting.
She and she's got to not come up to me and get be angry, going, "Why aren't you getting the kids yet? I don't understand it." And I'm like, "They got 10 more feet; they're fine, right?" And so those thresholds, when they're the same, rarely do we have conflict there, even if we see it differently, because we kind of we engage with it similarly at the emotional level. And so I'm sure those 10% they have sexual issues, but they probably don't come up as often because their thresholds are so similar, even if they interpret them differently. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. No, that's, and that, I think those are really good analogies that make sense of that. That's helpful because, and I do think, I mean, even going back to that identity issue that you mentioned, I think one of the things that has been so difficult in Christian community, Christian culture is, well, and I, you talk about in the book, and maybe we can touch on that a little bit more, what we are told, those misconceptions of, what did you say? Oh, it's like how boys are only in the relationship for sex,
Oh,
girls only
yes.
do the sex
Okay.
for the relationship. I
This is
don't know, that's not exactly
literally,
what it
this
is,
is
but yeah.
literally all I remember from all those years at youth camp. Wednesday night being sex and dating talk. And what I remember was a speaker saying this verbatim. Girls watch out for the guys because they play at love, which they don't understand, in order to get sex, which is what they really want. Girls play at sex, which they don't understand, in order to get love, which is what they really want. So one, there's zero research to back that type of a broad statement. And in fact, all the research defies it. That's a great way for some anxious-ridden, white, middle-class, male, evangelical dad preacher to warn boys away from his daughter or warn his daughter away from boys, right? But it's a lie, and it sets up every single male female in that room to act suspiciously of the other. And then you also know fundamentally girls are good and fundamentally boys are bad. And so, because men are just kind of animals in heat, And women's job is to fight them off, and men's job is to push the boundaries. And I know that's not what that speaker, I don't even remember who it was, intended to deliver, but is what he delivered was that message. And so how do we learn? One, women pursue sex too, and women can very much so enjoy sex, love sex. And that's one of the things that struck me as a counselor was how often I hear, especially Christian women, say that if I say, hey, you ought to seduce your husband as homework this week, that she'll give me that, that mother's a preschooler sigh. Because she's trying to figure out where she's going to get the energy to do that if she's got young kids, right? Oh man. It doesn't mean she doesn't like having sex with her husband. And she'll say, I love when we do. I'm always glad when we do. It's always fun. He's good at it. He makes me feel good. He makes me feel loved in that moment, and I love the bond. But then the problem is the next time she thinks of it, she doesn't see all of that. She still sees it as a behavior. And she and also probably by then she probably has some resentment that she feels like he prefers sex to her. And that's kind of the pop quiz thing that I do where the couples fights with each other all day. And at the end of the day, he says, so do you want to mess around? And she's like all offended and like, what? Because and I use that to teach men, okay, men, can you see that she interprets that as you had me all day and you didn't know, you don't even like me, you don't enjoy me, but you still want sex. And then I tell the women, and this works really good in a big group, I will say, imagine, ladies, if he sat down with you knee to knee and said, I want you to know that even after a really hard day like today, I still choose you. And I only want to be chosen by you. I know it's been a hard day, but you're my favorite and you're who I choose. And I, even though it's been a tough day. And I will say that, Aaron, and women in the room are getting tears in their eyes when I say that. And I'm like, because that's what he thought he said. When he said, do you want to mess around? He thought you intuited that the same way he did, which is this is about being chosen. And this is the best way to be chosen. And so that's a disconnect. So now he walks away hurt because she is like, are you kidding me? Like you get out of my face. He's crushed like an 8-year-old who brought Legos to his mother for Mother's Day and she yelled at him about it. She's brokenhearted because she thinks, well, he only cares about sex. He doesn't really care about me. And they missed it. And if they had understood that moment, how powerful it could have been as a what God intended as a bonding moment.
And I do think, like, just that setup, like you said, the camp setup, like what we all, and I think this was true probably through the 90s early. And I think they're doing it different now. I hope they are for our kids. But I think that that set us up to be like almost, yeah, suspicious of each other, or it's definitely set up females to be suspicious of men's motivations. And that carried on through marriage. And that's probably where you have that mom that's like, oh, well, this is what they warned me about, right? And it's like it's almost like we spoke that into existence without ever giving the men a chance to just love their wives the way they want to love their wives, right? And
And
like women are like, what?
and we internalized it too. That's who we are. I mean, we were taught so many times the truth. And that's, of course, that's what media tells us. Of course, it's what the secular sociologists tell us is that we're cavemen. And that's bad enough when the secular media says all men care about is sex and the secular sociologists say that. Why are the Christian authors buying into that? Why are the Christian speakers buying into that without actually looking at what the Bible says? And what the truth is. And I understand it. Once I understood the perspective, I was like, how often have I crippled my wife because the way I communicated sounded to her from her perspective as though what I wanted was sex. And when I didn't intuit it that way, and I thought she understood it the same way I did. And so I'm so confused about, why it's so easy for her to say no to me. And in her mind, all she's saying no to is sex, which is, I don't want to play badminton either. Like it's just a behavioral option. Those are the many things we could do to bond. And she doesn't see it as being integrated into her identity like I do. So she doesn't. And that's why, again, Shanti Felden did a great job in her first two books saying to women, you can't say no to sex without saying no to your husband. And to men only, she said, your wife can say no to sex without saying no to you. And that began to help me go down the path of, oh, this may be explain what's happening here, why this is getting where it is. And when we learn to think from the other person, to care enough to be willing to sacrifice our own way of thinking, to deny our own way of thinking and start learning to see it from theirs, then it's which is what so much of what marriage is.
Right. Like that's what we have to do. Otherwise, we're just stuck all the time. And that goes back to the, even the beginning about that unhealth. If you're not willing to see something from the other person's perspective, then why are you even married?
Right.
Like that's kind of the
Exactly.
point.
Yes, it really is. And also, by the way, this is probably a good time to comment. This does break down when you're dealing with an abusive person.
Yeah,
Now,
good point.
it doesn't break down philosophically or conceptually, but when you have someone who is absolutely unwilling, I hate to say unable because I don't know if I believe in that, but unwilling to see from another person's perspective that all they live in a predator-prey relationship, and they put the other person in a constant state of fight, flight, or freeze. And I actually, one of my areas of specialty is working with narcissistic pattern men and their families. And I know I'm beating my head against a wall. It's just that no one else will do it. And there's only a handful of men who I've seen break out of that pattern of thinking. And the problem is loving here. So here's what I would tell your listeners: loving someone who is truly abusive, you still have to love them and sacrifice for them, but they can't tell you what that looks like. They will tell you, this is what it would look like to love me, but they don't understand what love is. And so that's why you have to learn to draw healthy boundaries with them, because they're insisting that you love someone who doesn't actually exist. They want you to love the facade. They don't want you to love the real person. And so it's impossible to love a facade. And they don't, but they don't care. That's why they're willing to allow you to fear the facade rather than to love the real person, because they can control that. Obviously, that's a whole other podcast
Yeah,
conversation.
right. No, but that is
That.
I'm glad you mentioned that because that's important, and I know that that is a struggle. And I don't think, again, going back to Christian culture, over the years, we haven't always addressed that topic well, especially when it comes to narcissistic behaviors and whether that's a set in stone thing or it is something that can be changed, which is a whole other podcast would be
Yeah,
interesting to talk about.
exactly. Yes.
But I would
I
like
hear
to
you there.
ask about the importance of this whole transactional way of thinking that we have. I want you to explain that for people that are like, well, what does that mean? And how can we get past that and establish emotional safety for both parties?
Yeah, that's great. So transactional, it basically comes down to this idea that there's certain things that each person wants in life. And what they're doing is trying to find someone who can take care of those. They're often called needs in the therapeutic world. I truly have learned to despise the word needs. One, because it's no fun to just meet someone's needs. Like that's unhealthy. And if I'm with someone because I need her, that's not healthy. Like I don't need my wife. I should be able to experience reality and life in a healthy way by myself with just me and God. And so now there are certain, you could verbalize it. When people use the word need with me, I ask them, you need in order to what? So like, I don't need all the puzzle pieces, but I need all the puzzle pieces if I'm going to finish a puzzle. Okay, so I get that. And there are certain things you go like, in order to have a healthy marriage, there are certain ingredients that it probably needs. But we usually refer to them as ours. Like, I have these sexual needs or these emotional needs or these whatever needs. And it's like, but is it somebody else's job to meet my needs? And so, and plus, it's no fun to do it. Like, that's not fun. And I don't want my wife to love me a certain way because I need her to. I want her to do it because she wants to and she chooses to,
Totally.
or even if it's a full-blown sacrifice that she's wants to sacrifice that whatever this thing is, right? And that can be super, super healthy. When it's treated as a need, often those become a sense of expectation or entitlement or even abusive. And that's why I kind of shy away from it. You will appreciate working with a wife of a narcissistic and abusive man. She starts describing his perfect cup of coffee to a group of women, like down to the tiniest like ounces of this. But the whole time she's telling it, she's got tears in her eyes because she does this because there's going to be hell to pay if she doesn't do it right. And we'd unpacked as a group, think how beautiful it would be if this was a choice on her part to go, I have learned my husband's exact perfect cup of coffee and I can make it and no one else can. That's called intimacy. If it's healthy, it's a good thing. If it's there's a price to pay if I don't, then it's not, it's hard. How do you make that love? It's just fear. And so that's when we can learn to go, I see it, and I can give him a cup of coffee because I get to do that. My job is to create an awesome life for him, and his job is to create an awesome life for me. It's not my job is to create an awesome life for me, and you're a piece of that puzzle. I have sex needs, so I got to find a woman so that I can have sex. And she's going, I have protection and provision needs, so where do I find a man to take care of that? And by the way, men have the same emotion often about their own, about our ability to provide. If you're a super wealthy single man, this is where men get this, a super wealthy single man, every time a woman shows interest in him, he wonders, is this about me or is this about my money? What most men don't know is that virtually, in my experience, all women, probably not all, there's no universals like that, but virtually all women have wondered, is this about me or is this about sex? At least at some point. And to understand those things are locked in. And women being able to provide for her family is locked into her identity. She's not rarely, I mean, yes, I failed and discovered that like 3% or 4% of men, when you ask questions like, you can have sex with your wife anytime you want, but she won't be into it. Is that a good sex life? That something like 97% of men said no.
Oh
That's not
wow,
a good sex life.
that's hopeful.
Oh, it did. It was shocking, which again throws totally flies in the face of what you would expect. Like when she asked questions like that, well, and you and I know 3% is diagnosable. Those are your narcissists and your sociopaths,
Totally,
right?
100%, yeah.
And so the 90 something percent of normal men would say, no, the whole purpose of the sexual encounter is the encounter. It's not the sex, it's the encounter that matters. And I try to make that case in the book using several of those statistics. But so I think it's not a transaction. It's not you've got a commodity and your job is to provide me with enough of that commodity to keep me around. Because by the way, both of you will learn how to give as little of that commodity as you possibly can if it's just a contract, if it's just a transaction, especially if you don't want to give up that commodity. And so when you see marriages, and I know you do, where the man is totally in control of the money, for example, he works, she doesn't have access to the checking account, she has one credit card that has some kind of low limit on it. Well, you know, this is a transactional marriage for him. And he's trying to control the commodity that he has the most control over. Or when you, those are examples. And so when you see this commodity exchange, this is a cave person marriage. It's not a godly marriage. It's not an Adam and Eve marriage that God intended.
It's so funny because and we see that. So we love watching Love is Blind because it totally shows that transactional part of things. Like, why do you want to get married? Well, I want somebody to make me happy, right? And that's
Yes.
transactional. If you're
Oh
wanting
my
somebody
gosh,
to make you
yes.
happy, no human's going to make you happy. Like, good
No,
luck with
sorry.
that. And so,
Yes.
but we see that. We've watched every season of Love is Blind. I don't know why. I think I'm fascinated by human behavior. He's a
Sure.
counselor. Maybe that's what it is. But yeah, and it's always just kind of the same pattern from the secular view. But even as Christians, we get wrapped up in that too, because it's hard to separate culture from your belief system anyway,
Oh my gosh.
right? So
And they're
yeah. Oh,
pushing it constantly. And if you
totally.
hear it in your church, you go to a women's conference. No kidding, Aaron. My wife went to a women's conference a year ago. So the lady goes, okay, today's topic, we're going to talk a little bit about sex. And fundamentally, ladies, it comes down to this. Sometimes you just got to take one for the team.
Oh, stop.
I'm not kidding. And Ginger came in and told me that. And I was like, I am so
Oh,
enraged. But here's the truth, Aaron. At
take one for the
that point, I
team.
didn't
Wow.
understand this yet. And she and I were still trying to figure this out. Because early on in marriage, it wasn't a problem because she had plenty of energy. If it cost her 20% or 10% of her daily energy to engage sexually, we had no kids. We had no requirements. She was going to bed with 60% of her morning energy. She still had. You start having kids, and those energy levels just get depleted. You start having bigger responsibilities. And the first night that I go, hey, do you want to mess around? And she, every other time for the first several years of marriage, had said, sure, that sounds great. And she goes, I don't think I can. Something just changed. What just changed? Like, and for me, I'm going, I'm depleted. I'm exhausted. I have no energy. I can engage. We can engage sexually together, and it will be worth it's. it costs nothing and is worth 40. For her, it costs 20 and is worth 40. And what all these transactional books do is they try to tell the woman, no, it's worth 40 to him. Oh no, okay, so fine, it's worth 50. It's worth $1 million to him. And the husband's going, yeah, this is so important. What's happened? And that neither the book nor the husband understands they're not solving the right problem. She doesn't have 20. And so how do you begin to restructure the marriage and the relationship in such a way? How does she begin to discipline her life? And he does too, by the way. So that if she goes, oh, this is a threshold that's very important to me, is that you help me with this. And he's like, at the end of the day, that's going to cost me 20 points. I don't have it. Well, brother, you need to restructure your life so that you somehow get home with a few points left to invest in your wife. And sister, you need to learn how to restructure your life so you've got some points left over. Now, it doesn't mean you have to spend them on sex. That's the old, how many pastors over the years, and I love pastors. We have a tough job. I mean, but it is natural for pastors sometimes to step out of their lane. And that's a bad habit some pastors have. I love, by the way, Francis Chan's book on marriage because he
It's so
doesn't step
good.
out of his lane.
I
He
agree.
doesn't try to get into the therapeutic world. He doesn't try to answer. Almost every other pastor who writes a book about marriage and sex drifts out of their lane, and you probably learn more about their marriage hangups and their
That's
sexual
true.
hangups than you do about the real world, their poor wives. But instead, to look at the at what the actual research says. And so I love that Chan did a great job of staying in the lane of what is the theology of marriage, because he's brilliant. It is a brilliant book. Let people who know how to do research like the Feldens promote the what does the research teach us. And then that was why I wanted to bring those, merge those together, because I'm one of those few people who's a pastor and a therapist. And so how do I bring those world together for the rest of us? And it ends up with a 300 plus page book that probably too many people
Yeah, no, it's in it, but it has all
about.
of the elements that we do need. And I think it's important. I mean, what you just mentioned, the energy expenditure. I mean, I've
Yes.
talked to young
Sorry.
moms who are like, I'm just all touched out, you know?
Yes.
Like it's
Right.
like people are on them all day long, and then the husband wants to, you know, have a piece of that, but it's like I can't even translate in my brain these little
Yes.
people and now the husband. I've got nothing left. And then you right when you get past that phase, something we talk about on this podcast a lot, you get into perimenopause. And
Yes.
then the libido starts to tank for the women naturally. And so, and that's a physiological issue, but I do think if the man, and I'm probably going to be a little bit harder on the men here just because
I am
I
too. We're
think they
good.
can take it. But I think if the man is continuing to pursue intimacy and
Yes.
vulnerability and those emotional conversations with their wives, I think the wives can get there. But I think a lot
Yes.
of times they're also wrapped up in their own load of life and workload and how am I going to pay for college and the car and the insurance because my
And
kid
my
just got
aging
into a wreck.
parents and all the things.
Oh,
Yep. All my friends
yes.
are freaking out
So
and
it's
getting
almost like
divorced.
it flip-flops. So the man almost feels more emotionally burdened as they get older just because of that stuff. And then the woman's like, my body's doing crazy things. I don't even know what's going on. So how can we, and I guess this will be one of my last questions because we're going to run out of time, continue to invest in going back to that idea of emotional safety and conversations and being on the same page because life is veering in all sorts of directions at this point.
I believe that the hormones and the decisions and the mindsets all interrelate. And so very often the woman who already feels a lot of resentment about their sex life because she feels like her husband chooses sex over her, then those hormones start changing and those two storylines coincide.
Interesting,
And so instead of I teach men to think in terms of arousal as like a door with locks, and different. So women ought typically have more locks on their door than men do anyway. Again, that's probably partially hormones, probably partially the way we integrate these things. But so men do make a lot of decisions throughout the day that often lock the door for their wife, and then the wife doesn't have the hormonal push to engage sexually. But she also now has no emotional push to engage sexually. She doesn't feel connected to him. She doesn't want to choose him. She doesn't want to be chosen by him. And she doesn't feel it, right? And so what I teach men to do is that women, it turns out, all day long are teaching us how to unlock the door. And so this was one of the insights that blew my mind. And I think it's in the book. I may have learned it after, but was the when women say, hey, could you slow down? You're driving too fast, or you're following that car too closely, or he brings her flowers and she goes, "Oh, I love these, but yellow
Yeah,
roses are
you
my
mentioned
favorite."
that.
Yeah, and then in the but then in the bedroom, that if she says he's trying to give her sexual pleasure and she goes, "That feels good, but do it a little slower." Well, for men, those are three, and we intuit those conversations very differently. This is the criticism and versus consultation. And when I asked women, what is the difference between those three conversations? And the women are like, there's no difference between those conversations. Those are all the same conversation. And once I tell men, so what that means is when she says, "Hey, could you slow down? I think you're following that car too closely," you can say, "Hey, I can freaking pull over if you want to drive." Or you can say, "Well, sure, I can slow down. That's not a big deal. That's low hanging fruit. I can do that." And what that does is, you don't know it, but that just unlocked her arousal. That just unlocked a lock on her arousal door, or it
She
certainly
feels
didn't lock.
cared for, yeah,
That's right.
and
And so
heard.
what has to happen is, when it comes time to engage sexually, the less locks there is that you have to make her choose to unlock versus that are intuitively unlocked, it's way more likely to engage sex. She's going to want to and going to feel
Absolutely.
arousal. And especially as ladies get older, but often many women are this way all the time, they have a reactive arousal anyway. They're not just sitting there feeling sexual. But if they start engaging in sexuality, those feelings will start bubbling up. And so I will tell your this is the power of intimacy. This is where intimacy takes over for novelty, is that I tease my wife. She'll hate that I say this probably, but I tease my wife when I'm like, "Hey, do you want to mess around?" And she's like, "Oh, I don't know." I will tease her by saying, "Just give me 10 seconds, then tell me no." Right? Because I know if you give me 10 seconds, you're not going to tell me no, because I know her. No other man could do that, but I've known her for 31 years. And I know what will keep what like, and she might very much so react in a positive way, but she has to choose to say, "Okay, I'm going to give you 10 seconds," right? And if I've locked all those arousal doors throughout the day by being a jerk or just by not being kind, then she's not going to give me those 10 seconds because she doesn't. I've locked those doors. So I really tell men this is a key part of it. That's why the second half of the book, there's a whole section on investing in romance, investing in arousal, investing in intimacy, and then investing in pleasure. And honestly, Aaron, a lot of that is written, it's written to both, but it's probably best for the men. They need
It
it more.
is. I did feel like and I, my counselor husband be the same way. He says he likes to be a little bit harder on the men just as a man, because I think it's easier for men to do that than women, because then we just seem naggy, right? But I do think it's important to address that, because there was so much for years, depending on what generation you grew up in, on the woman, like, oh, well, don't lead the men on, or oh, don't do this, or we just got all these talking to's.
Wifely duties, yeah.
And so it's
Ugh.
like, finally, the men are getting some attention too. And I think that will long term create a healthier marriage. I will say, I mean, this is a last thing. It's interesting. My husband grew up in mostly a secular household, didn't become a believer till later in life. And he has a very different perspective of sex and intimacy than a lot of Christians. So it's just, and then even me, I had more hangups than he did, even though he went to a Christian Bible college and stuff. And so I think that's interesting too, just that. What were you told about sex and how that plays a role? I mean, that's going to be different for everybody. But the last question I will ask before I get all of your information on where to find your book is, the name of the show is Sparking Wholeness. So if you could give one piece of advice to spark someone toward wholeness, what would it be?
Wow. Okay. In general, or because what I would say is, I think it is fascinating that in the garden, God saw Adam, he had created, and said, "It's not good that Adam is alone." And it's intriguing to me that God didn't say, "So I better start getting some more time with Adam." He created Eve to fulfill something that God saw. Adam apparently was blissfully unaware, right? And so God saw this thing in Adam that he wanted to create a more fulfilled picture, which I believe was God creating a picture of God's relationship to his people. And he created someone who was a peer to Adam, someone who was like Adam. And I think we commit to a covenant to these marriages, so we might as well make them great. I believe when Jesus says, "Where your treasure is, your heart will follow," that is not a nice thing to say about us. That is very mercenary. It's not sweet. Sweet would be to say, "Oh, your treasure will follow your heart," but he knows us too well. Our heart will follow our treasure. So investing our treasure, what I tell people all the time, if you want to have a whole life, invest your time, talent, money, strategic thinking, intentionality in the things that you want your heart to follow. Jesus is talking about his kingdom. His kingdom is made up of people. We need community. We need friendship. We need healthy opposite sex relationships, especially in marriage. We need that. Investing in those things. And look at your life and see, where am I investing treasure in a place that will end up being worth nothing to me that I don't want my heart to follow? Is it doom scrolling online because I'm investing time, which is very difficult to get? And I'm investing it there, and it's a huge waste. I don't know what it is for each person, but to analyze their life and see, where am I investing life in something that isn't life-giving, that isn't eternal, and then start switching it, start investing in the things that places you want your heart to go, invest there. There you
That's
go.
awesome. Yeah, no, I love that. Okay, so where can people get your book? And
Yeah, I will comment quickly. I think what your husband has the advantage of is he learned. So the secular world said sex is common. The church came along in reaction and said sex is trash. And what we should have said was sex is sacred. And that's a
Yeah,
whole
I agree
section in the
with
book as
that.
well. And so we if we teach the truth, we have a huge advantage over the world. Sacred is much better than common or trash. But this response where the church said no, it's trash, was a huge mistake. And it actually literally, like you said, gave the world some advantages over the church.
It's a
Because common is
shame.
closer than trash is to sacred. Anyway,
Yeah, such a shame. You're right. Yeah.
so you can go on Amazon. It's on Amazon. We've got it here at the Aletheia Family Counseling Center. You can go by and pick up a copy there. If you visit the church, you can have a free copy. They give out a book to everybody who comes, and one of the books you can choose from is this one. Although there are also books by like Brendan Manning and Henri Nouwen, and so I don't know if you want to pick mine, get theirs. But and then like so Amazon is the best place. We're working on the audio. It doesn't exist yet, but it is on
Nice.
Kindle, and it is also paperback you can buy. And so anyway, and then and I'm ex I mean we'll have to talk later about, I heard that Tyndale's publishing your upcoming book, so that's
Yes.
super exciting.
Super cool.
Congratulations. That's really
Yeah,
cool.
thanks.
I
Yeah.
had no margin in my life, and so there was no reason to try to publish through a publisher. I don't know if they would have or not, but there was no reason because I have no margin to do
Yeah.
any type of tours or interviews,
Yeah.
and so all I could do are podcasts, so this is great. But
Yeah. I'm so glad you did. Thank you so
yes,
much
this has
for coming
been
on. This is
great.
such a good conversation.
Yes, so the church's website, chrismlegg.com, southspring.org, that's
And
us.
Aletheia, if you're looking for a good Christian
Yes.
counselor or trauma therapy, all those things. So I will link all those in the show notes.
Thank you so much. It's been great. Thanks, Aaron.
The tiniest spark leads to the biggest blaze, and I hope that today's episode sparks you on a journey to healing and wholeness. Thanks for listening to Sparking Wholeness. For more information on what I do and my coaching programs, or maybe just to reach out and say hey, find me at sparkingwholeness.com or on Instagram at sparkingwholeness. Have a fabulous week.